Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Mark Stark from the International Advocate for Glycoprotein Storage Diseases. So tell me a little bit about your experience advocating for glycoprotein storage diseases.
Sure. I first became acquainted with the organization because my son has alpha-man acidosis, a rare glycoprotein storage disorder. So he has a genetic defect and therefore does not produce an enzyme that would normally eliminate this glycoprotein in the cell. And so he accumulates a lot of it, a little bit like if you accumulated garbage in your kitchen over a long period of time, there was no way to get rid of it. And so that affects his cellular development. So I became acquainted with it once we had a diagnosis. At that time, it was that was about 12 years ago, in 2002, that I first became acquainted with ISMRD. And at that time, really, there was no information at all available from our doctors or from very many people about the disorder. But a couple of people had started an organization called ISMRD, International Society for Asbestosis and Rare Diseases. And they helped us get in contact with other people that had been through some of the therapies that we were considering for our son, in particular bone marrow transplant. And so I became involved with the organization over time, went to a family conference, and became a board member. And so I've been a board member of ISMRD since 2004. And our primary purpose is really to try to get information to families who are affected by these glycoprotein storage disorders. They do not have a lot of resources. It's not a well-known disease. Most doctors have never heard of it. And they're spread across the world. So fortunately, we do have the internet now. There can be a central location where people can go to and find a lot of information. So our primary purpose is really to first provide information to families. Secondly, we partner with other organizations that work with genetic diseases on legislation to improve screening, early diagnosis for these diseases. Still, most of these diseases are not tested for in infancy. And unfortunately, they're progressive diseases that the longer they go before detection and treatment, the more disability results for the children. Our child, unfortunately, was not diagnosed until he was 5. And by the time he was 6, he finally was successfully bone marrow transplanted. But by then, there was a fair amount of neurological damage from the disorder. In the recent years, we've been able to set up family conferences and have families from all over the world come and listen to experts on both the technology and the therapies available. And we've also been able to bring together researchers at these conferences to present work that's going on in various laboratories and hospitals around the world, and to interest new researchers, young researchers in this area. And we've helped do that through scholarship, of course, funding the conferences, providing scholarships to young researchers, and scholarships to families to attend. Sorry, are you still there?
Yes.
Okay. And in terms of advocacy, again, a lot of our focus is to work with other larger organizations, like the Genetic Alliance is kind of in the United States is an umbrella organization with a lot of different advocacy organizations to get more funding for rare disease research, because fundamentally there's not a lot of profit motive for rare diseases for drug companies. They're not going to, you know, get back the cost of a new drug development program like they would from diabetes or heart disease. So there has to be some incentives provided, both in terms of financing as well as some relief for the drug companies who do pursue these therapies for rare diseases.
So
early detection, government funding for research, and government support of companies that are willing to make investment in these therapies are kind of the main areas that we focus on. We're a very small organization because of very limited number of patients, only a few hundred that we know of in the world, so we don't have a lot of funds, but we try to leverage them and work together with other organizations to get the maximum benefit. So that's a summary of what we do. Have I answered the question, or
absolutely,
do you have a follow-up?
So, in your time with the organization, what sorts of challenges have been faced?
Well, I think the biggest challenge any organization faces is raising funds in nonprofit. It's very, very difficult to get people interested in a global disorder that's very rare. It's a lot easier to get people interested in a local problem that affects their community than in a disorder where people may not know anyone that's affected. In fact, most people don't. That's one challenge. For the same reason, it's a challenge getting your voice heard by government agencies. And it's also very difficult getting pharmaceutical companies and researchers interested in the research for these, because again, they're not very well known, they're not very visible. There's not going to be a lot of grant money for work on rare diseases. So for all those reasons, making yourself relevant, keeping the interest going, has always been a challenge. We went through a period where we tried to operate as other nonprofits operate, with paid employees. And there's a lot of, in addition to the cost of the employees, there's a lot of structural costs of managing an organization with paid employees. And that we found that we were just simply not able to have enough of the funding that we were raising going to research or going to conferences or going to keeping the information flowing when we had structural costs, when we had overhead costs. So we've transitioned to an all-volunteer organization with no paid employees. With that, it's much more difficult to get as much work out of a group of volunteers, obviously. So, when you have a professional fundraiser working for you, the grants get written more frequently, you attend more meetings, all those kind of things. Personally, I've got a few motivated people on the board that are willing to do the work for free in order to help families. But getting sufficient momentum is always difficult. And their children get older, their children pass away, they may not be as motivated to continue to work with us. And so that's the other problem we've seen is when parents who become initially very involved when their children get transplanted, the bone marrow transplant, and they're healthy, or their children pass away, they tend not to stick with a sponge. So keeping a motivated group of board members is also one of the challenges.
So to look at the converse side of things, in your time with the group, has there been any one success moment that stands out for you?
Really, the ones that I see are, there's really been two in recent times where I'd say we reached a broad group of people. We had a family conference in 2012 in North Carolina, and we had another family conference several years earlier in Rockville, Maryland. Those were really two, they were joint scientific and family conferences. And they were real successes because we were able to pull together some funding from the National Institute of Health. So we had some federal funding to help support the conference. We were able to get really all of the leaders in research in glycoprotein diseases to attend. And people from all around the world came to present, to interact, to introduce this, this set of disorders to potential researchers. And we were able to bring, at the same time, a family conference that ran subsequent. So we had a couple of days of a technical conference that really was researchers and clinicians. And then we had a family conference, which some of the clinicians participated in that, who had come for the scientific conference, also participated in a presentation for information and therapy to the families. And we were, in addition to that, able to do a natural history study at the Greenwood Genetics Center in South Carolina. And that's really the a very important step in doing a disease model, is to collect the natural history. Natural history is the normal progression of the disease in people if untreated, compared to how people normally develop, and that's an important part in building the overall picture of the disease, so that when people start doing therapy, they have a model to test it against. Did a specific therapy work against what you see in the natural history study? So that was really the kind of high point, was the summer of 2012, when we managed to pull all those three things together, a scientific conference, a family conference, and a natural history study. We got doctors from, experts in the field, meeting with families, taking the natural history, doing the blood samples, doing the genetic samples, and we were able to fund a lot of families to come there. So it was about 3 years of fundraising it took us to put all that together, but we were very pleased with the results. So I think that was probably our single outstanding achievement that I'm very proud of what we were able to do there.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Sarah is 5. She's saving up for big things. A bike, a microscope, a cure for MS. Her mom has MS, and she's saving up to fix her. When you participate in the Mandarin MS Walk, you're adding momentum to the cutting-edge MS research for which Canada is known. Lace up for the Mandarin MS Walk and transform hope into reality for 100,000 Canadians with MS, beginning right where you live. Register today at mswalks.ca. A message from everyone at Design Systems Canada, 3585 Rhodes Drive in Windsor.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Mark Stark. He was sharing his insights into glycoprotein storage diseases. Now, before we get to our next segment, folks, I wanted to take a second to say thanks to all the wonderful fans of this show who took the time out to vote in this year's Jammy Awards. You folks are what it's all about. Work that goes on here at the station for any show couldn't go on without the support. Listeners like you. And to each one of us here at the station who got a vote for their program, it is appreciated. So on behalf of myself and HandyLink, I'd like to say thanks. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Jenny Noble, Vice President for the International Advocate for Glycoprotein Storage Diseases. So tell me a little bit about your experience with the Advocate for Glycoprotein Storage Diseases.
I guess it's quite unique, because you're advocating for families all around the world, really. I think being part of ISMRD is it's an amazing experience. To be able to support families and have those contacts come from, you know, not just the United States or Canada, but all over the world.
So, how did you get involved with the organization?
In 2004, ISMRD brought in a group of diseases called mucolipidosis into their network, and I was asked by Paul Murphy, who was the president at that time, to come to their first international conference held in Washington to moderate the mucolipidosis group and to be there for the support people, for the families, you know, that were coming to that meeting.
So, since that time, how have you seen the organization grow or evolve?
Have I seen it grow? I think it's grown in a way that we have a voice now. We've just had one of our parents who's on the board of ISMRD go to Capitol Hill and advocate for rare disease policy, fast tracking of therapies for rare diseases. Yeah, so I do think we're growing in a really good way.
So what sorts of policies would you like to see put in place for these diseases?
I think the major one is rare disease policy. Some countries in the world don't have that, and I guess New Zealand is an example where we don't have an orphan drugs access program, so where there are therapies, families in New Zealand don't get those treatments. I think there needs to be a rare disease policy across the board that helps all families have proper access to care, proper access to disability services.
So, in your time with the organization, what sorts of challenges have you seen?
I think our major challenge is trying to raise money to support the organisation, to support research, to run our conferences. I think being very, very small, so these numbers for these diseases worldwide are really tiny, and being international but based in the United States, we don't fit any of the grant funding criteria. So we have huge problems trying to raise money just to do the work that we would like to do.
So to look at the other side of things, in your time advocating for these diseases, has there been any one success moment that stood out for you?
Yeah, definitely. So for me, it's the work that I have done in regards to bisphosphonate treatment for children with severe bone disease. I have two children myself with mucolipidosis, and these kids suffer from chronic pain. And I used to always ask the doctors what was wrong, why are they suffering from this pain, and they used to tell me that it was just part of the disease. And I never accepted that. I never accept that, well, that's just part of the disease and there's nothing we can do. And so I started working with a professor in Sydney, Australia, to work out what was going on with these kids. And we discovered that they had very, very severe osteopenia or osteoporosis. And he recommended bisphosphonate treatment or pimidronate for these children. And I think the most rewarding part of that was that we treated, we wrote a medical paper, we presented the data at a scientific meeting, and from there, I myself took it out all around the world. And we see children today with severe bone disease and mucolipidosis and some of the other lysosomal storage diseases being treated with this treatment and having really, really good outcomes. You know, and that was back in 2002, and I still get contacted today by families who see my story, see what we've done, and ask how they can get their children treated. And I think working through ISMRD has allowed those doors to open and has allowed me to reach the families that desperately need, you know, that information.
So, are there any projects on the horizon for IMSRD?
ISMRD? Yes. We have a major project that we have been working with since 2005, and that's a natural history study. We collaborate and work alongside the lead investigator from the Greenwoods Genetic Center in South Carolina. And that initially started with mucolipidosis, and in 2012, at our last international meeting, we extended it to the other diseases that ISMRD supports. And so for us, that's it's an ongoing commitment to the Greenwoods Genetic Center that we will endeavor to find additional funding to support families going to the clinic, or to support a family going through, or so a new family going through diagnosis and going through gene mutation analysis. So that's an ongoing project. We've just joined in partnership with the US MPS Society, and we're supporting another research project where they're looking at cardiac disease in mucolipidosis and looking at how it manifests and what they might be able to do to not correct it, but, you know, deal with the cardiac issues in these diseases.
So, if you could send any one message about the work that is going on concerning these diseases, what might it be?
If I could send a message... it could be any number of things. I guess it's the financial support to that will allow us to continue to do what we do. I mean, we still need to find families, and so it's about finding a way to reach out to them. You know, we know of pockets of families all around the world. It's having the tools, I think, to do the job.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. It's organizations like these, folks, that remind me, no matter how rare how seemingly isolated a condition may seem to be, there's always hope and always support. It may take little more time to find the right people out there who can and will stand by you. The truth of the matter is, in disability life, not only is it a lot easier to face when you have someone in your corner, someone telling you you can do these things, or there is that little bit of hope in the middle of what can appear to be a dark situation. But it's just common sense practice in everyday life that facing a challenge, especially a big one, on your own can be just a daunting task. However, if you look at it from the perspective that there are others beside you, there's strength in numbers, folks. Really is an important thing to always recognize that you're never alone. Many times I have heard of individuals meeting somebody with their same condition for the very first time. It can be a real eye-opening experience. Change the world for them. Even if it's a very common condition, it can be hard to recognize sometimes that there are others out there of like mind, like condition. But meeting that someone, a support organization, an individual, a group of individuals, can really change everything for you. I mean, working together, you can build one of the most important things for the future, hope. The first step in the process of disability life is saying, I'm looking for hope. I might not be able to find a cure immediately, but I might be able to find a way to make things a little better as we go. And that is laying the groundwork, laying in the foundation for what can be a journey towards a better way of life. In order to find the right help, the right support, one of the key things is just being aware of one's own condition. Saying, these are the things I've experienced. Maybe it's common, maybe it's not, but I want to find out more. Then, proceeding from there, saying, I need someone to stand beside me, someone to help me understand. And that is where you begin the search. With the internet and social media, all the technological resources available, there's a wealth of information about any given condition, which isn't to say that all the information available is necessarily reputable. Should be something that can be confirmed by multiple sources when it comes to disability life. Although, the safest approach and the first place a person should always check, speaking to a medical professional, say, these are the symptoms I've experienced. Is there anything that can be done? If it's a condition a doctor is not overly familiar with, ask to speak to someone who can. There's absolutely nothing wrong in disability life with recognizing one's own needs and asking to speak to the right person. Expect better of your medical establishment, folks. Say to them, if you don't understand this, I want to talk to someone who does, because this is my life we're talking about, and my right to be at my best. For every person with a disability has hopes and dreams, potentials all their own, but it is a matter of being given the right tools and the right opportunities to succeed. And it begins when a person with a disability is aware of their own needs, their own rights, and is able to assert them, to take steps in a direction that can make things that much better. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. You've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.